From the Gable Media Podcast Network and presented by Lines, this is Spaces, the podcast where we make sense of the spaces that shape society. I'm your host, Demetrius Lynch. Hello! Thanks for coming back. And if you're new here, welcome. This is episode 207. What if one of the answers to our housing crisis is already standing, empty, underused, and waiting to be reimagined? Today's conversation is about office-to-housing conversions, adaptive reuse, and the opportunity to transform vacant buildings into much-needed homes. I'm joined by Michael Bone, AIA, a partner with Studio 111, an integrated practice of architects, urban designers, and landscape architects dedicated to restoring communities. Michael leads the studio's affordable, modular, and adaptive reuse work, with a focus on transit-oriented development, urban infill, and mixed-use projects. Over his 35-year career, he has helped complete more than 2,500 housing units, with another 2,000 under construction or in planning. And as you'll hear, Michael's commitment to existing buildings goes far beyond professional interests, but I'll let him tell that story. In our conversation, Michael also explains why adaptive reuse is not just a design strategy, but a housing, sustainability, and community strategy. We discuss office vacancies, embodied carbon, affordable housing, zoning ordinances, construction surprises, and why cities need more flexibility if they want these conversions to succeed. Enjoy. All right, Michael, thank you for joining me.
It's an honor to be with you today, Demetrius. Thank you.
Looking forward to this conversation. This is one that hasn't really taken over the zeitgeist, but I think will in a very short amount of time, talking about office to housing conversion. I know of some projects that have happened, and I know you guys are actively in it. So looking forward to hearing more about the process and what you do and your approach. But before we get into that, can you kind of give our listeners a little bit of a baseline? Tell us a little bit about yourself and Studio 111.
Sure. Well, I'm a California native. I was born and grew up in Southern California, studied outside the region and worked abroad, traveled abroad, and just kind of came back and fell in love with the region and have practiced here ever since. I'm one of two partners with Studio 111, and Studio 111 is really an integrated practice of architects, landscape architects, and urban designers dedicated to restoring communities.
And is most of your work focused in the Southern California or kind of the Southwestern region, or do you guys expand out?
I think you're right. It's mostly in the Southern region. We have done some work in Boise as well as in Reno, but the vast majority of it here is in Southern California. And our headquarters is in Long Beach, which has been really a good testing ground. It's a smaller city. It's less than 500,000 people. And yet we have a great relationship with the community. And it gives us a chance to get our feet wet into new types of work. And then once we do two or three of those types of projects, we can take it on the road and pursue it in other cities, nearby cities as well.
Now, I understand a little bit of, or have heard a little bit more about your background than you let on there, about your passion about architecture and housing and our environment and maintaining existing buildings. So much so that you went to jail over it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, that was a friend of mine and I, we really love older buildings. And early on when I was just finishing college, a lot of cities had this urban renewal process where they would come in, clear cut, meaning just demolish neighborhoods and buildings for the sake of progress and to build newer things. And Long Beach did have its share of that, especially in the downtown. And what was particularly frustrating is that they were large buildings with a lot of character and a lot of mass to them. And many times newer things were replaced that weren't as dense and not as interesting. And I think what really upset me about this building called the Jurgens Trust Building is it was this beautiful historic building in the downtown. It went from block to block. It was six stories high. And they were just going to tear it down and not even make it into a parking lot. It was literally just going to be demolished and sit there as a vacant lot. And I'm sure it was the thought was this to attract some type of development. But he and I were just so upset that the day that the demolition crew came, we chained ourselves to the building and said, no, you're not going to do it here. And, you know, all the equipment stopped. Everybody stood around and they called the police. They came shortly thereafter, cut the chain, put us in the police car. We fortunately did not go to jail. We went to the police station and they told us, don't go back there again and we'll let you go. And so we did. And I will say it was bittersweet and I don't have any regrets doing it. To this day, gosh, now almost 40 years ago, it is still an empty lot. And if that building was still there, I'm fairly confident that somebody would have seen the beauty in it and would have adaptively reused it for some type of use.
Yeah. Were you an architecture student or had you started on your architecture path by that point?
I did. I was going to school at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
Do you think you would have done the same thing if you were not on the architecture path? Would you have had that sort of perspective?
I think it helped a lot. And I want to be clear, I am not somebody that wants to build new buildings that look like old buildings. But I do believe that when you have something of substantial grace and beauty, that trying to preserve it and restore it or adaptively reuse it should always be first. And I like cities that have a mixture of new and old buildings. And I think it just creates an authenticity and a rich vibe that really sets it apart from other communities. And it just was so gut-wrenching to see these buildings come down. And now, you know, 40 years later, I think most of those buildings would be really vibrant and contributing to our economic base.
Yeah. And it's one of the most sustainable ways you can approach building in our industry is salvaging the ones that we've already built and upgrade and modify them for new uses. And it's such a waste, especially here in California, where we've maxed out pretty much on our buildable area. So it's important to reuse what we have because we don't necessarily have the space to do brand new anymore. And it makes much more sense to reuse what we have.
You raise a really good point. We've been studying a number of the adaptive reuse, particularly office to housing conversions, from a sustainability perspective, and we've learned that the reduced embodied carbon is anywhere from 60 to 80%, which is significant. And at the same time, our Santa Ana project, which is only five stories in height, we were able to reduce the amount of demolished product going to the waste stream or to the dump by 25 million tons. So there is a strong sustainable argument to make about this. And at the same time, I think there's a social argument. People generally are comfortable with buildings that are already in place, whereas when something new is proposed, it creates a lot of angst. You know, people in general are just afraid of change. And I think if we have found that when we do an adaptive reuse, we get very little community pushback because they already know what to expect. Maybe what happens inside the building changes, but the exterior massing and character generally stays the same. And I think that gives people a level of comfort and kind of expectation to know what's coming.
Now, let's dig in a little bit more to that office to housing conversion. If an alien were to come down on the planet, how would you describe to them what exactly you mean by office to housing conversion? It's pretty self-explanatory, but how would you explain it to them?
Well, maybe I'll explain it to you with also some context about where we are as a country. In 2019, the vacancy rate in our office market was about 10%, meaning 90% of our office buildings were full. And then COVID hit and people were allowed to work from home. Many of them still are allowed to work from home. And since then, the vacancy rate, this is nationwide, has doubled to about 20%. And there are certain cities like Austin, San Francisco, Seattle, where the vacancy rate is as high as almost 30%. So just think about 30% of a building just sitting there empty. Now, those are buildings that have leases. Within those leases, many times, only 50%, 30%, 25% of the people are coming into work, depending on what each individual business's work from home program is. And some of them are 100%. Everybody's required to come in. But that vacancy rate of 20% has stayed fairly steady, even now, you know, several years after COVID. And so we just have too much office space. Moody's Analytics has said that there's about 900 million square feet of office space sitting empty every day, which is about almost a billion square feet. And to get back to that 10% vacancy rate, we would have to get 450 million square feet of office space off the market. One way would be to demolish it. Another way would be to adaptively reuse that space. And I think at the same time, it's interesting, this year, I believe it was CBRE that said the amount of office space being added to the market is actually contracting, that there's less office space coming on the market, and it's shrinking due to office to housing conversions and other types of conversions that are occurring. And that's the first time that's happened in the 21st century. I will also add that this last year had the most office to housing conversions. And right now there's about 90,000 proposed residential units that would be added into buildings that were formerly offices. So we are in an upswing and we're in a strongest point than we've ever been. And it's really taking lemons and making lemonade out of the situation, because at the same time, we need a lot of housing in this country. Estimates are anywhere from 4 million to what I heard a couple days ago from the White House saying, we need 10 million more homes in this country. And that's really a focus on affordable housing, as well as missing middle housing or middle income housing. So again, you know, can we take these buildings that are empty and convert some of them to housing? And the answer is yes, absolutely.
Is the effort to convert an entire building or some portion of the building convert to residential and leave some office?
That is a really good question. All of our projects have been very straightforward. I think the simpler you can make it, the easier to get to success. So the six projects that we've completed have been literally straight conversions directly to office to housing with no mixture. Now, the ground floor in many of these buildings have remained in their use. So one of our smallest projects in Santa Ana was a food hall on the ground floor. It's only a two-story building. The upper floor was office. It was empty for many, many years. And we put in 28 units of housing. They're loft spaces. And we worked with the food hall still operating while this conversion was taking place. But to answer your question about mixing office and maybe a different use on the ground floor and housing, you have to realize that when you put housing in, you're putting a lot of plumbing fixtures in for kitchens and bathrooms. And all of those fixtures need a vent that goes up to vent the plumbing fixtures through the roof. And at the same time, need drains for the water. Once you wash your hands or use a shower or cook, that water needs to then drain downwards to the base of the building. So you're building shafts both up and down. And that can be really disruptive to whatever tenants you have in the building.
That's a good point. Let's come back to that and dig in a little bit more. But I want to kind of back out a little bit, because I know you're in this effort, you're changing the use of the building. Can you talk a little bit about that change of use process?
Absolutely. All the developments that we've worked on have been with cities that have an adaptive reuse ordinance. And Los Angeles in 1999 came up with a really great adaptive reuse ordinance. It said that any building from 1974 or older was by right allowed to be converted into housing. They provided minimum unit sizes. They allowed, instead of a prescriptive code for structural upgrades, a performance code, which provided more flexibility. And The only thing is it was only allowed in a few geographic areas within the city, in Koreatown and in downtown LA. And both those areas really started to spring back because in downtown Los Angeles, from when that code took effect to now, about 12,000 units of housing have been added. And, you know, not only has that taken off office space that was no longer performing well, it helped consolidate any tenants that were in those office buildings into other buildings to help stabilize or at least bring some more stability to some other office buildings. But it brought thousands of residents to downtown that now take a central business district or a certain area that was maybe sterile at nights and on weekends. And it's bringing residents into those areas that walk their dogs at night, that go jogging, that help support retail and restaurants and bars that maybe were struggling with just an office crowd, especially after the pandemic with fewer people occupying those districts. So I think in the long haul, it's going to create really more interesting mixed-use districts that will support all the buildings.
Those are some great points. Being able to consolidate and bring that stability in one location rather than spread out and have multiple non-performing buildings.
Right.
So after this use is kind of fleshed out, tell me a little bit about the process. What are some of the things that you and your team look at first when you get one of these projects and kind of navigate through that design process?
Well, I would say before we even put pencil to paper, there's three things that we're always looking out for. First of all, what is the footprint like? If you think of a new building, units are usually 30, 35 feet deep. There's a corridor and then another unit on the other side that's 30 or 35 feet deep. So you might have a building of 65 to 75 feet deep. If an office building has a deeper footprint, say 100 feet, that still might work because office buildings have generally taller floor-to-floor ceiling heights. And at the same time, they tend to have taller window heights. So they'll let natural light and ventilation deeper into units. So we might do units that are 40, 45 feet deep. And then at the same time, still keeping the corridor, those deeper footprints still can work. And then we have one in Long Beach where the building was 100 feet deep. So we had 45 foot deep units. And then on one side and then on the north side where there wasn't as much natural light coming in, the unit depth was less. I think it was 35 feet. But on the southern side, we actually pushed the units in and created 8 foot deep balconies because this building had great ocean views. And also from a sustainability perspective, pushing the storefront in 8 feet, now these exterior decks were shading the storefront, which then required a significant amount less energy to cool the building or heat the building in the wintertime. So we can work with depths to a certain degree. We also have, you never say a super deep unit doesn't work because we have a project we're looking at right now in Long Beach that has a deeper footprint, but we're looking at it for student housing and where the periphery of the building will remain housing for students. The core, which will have no natural light, but will serve as classrooms, study lounges, and workspaces for students that many times don't need natural light, and we can really successfully use that inner core, whereas with traditional housing, that space would be very difficult to utilize and probably would make the project not viable economically. So footprint is one big thing. The other question we would ask is, what are the leases with the remaining tenants and how long are they? You know, are they on long-term leases that are going to be expensive to buy out? And then the third thing is the age of the building. I think a lot of people think of high-rises that are adaptive reuses from the 20s, 30s, 40s, these beautiful brick buildings with wood windows. But a lot of our work have been mid-century buildings and more recently buildings from the 80s and 90s. And what we found is the newer the building in general, the less work that needs to be done to them. So we have a building, I actually started practicing architecture the same year this building came into being to be built in 1986. And it needs very little work to it. The seismic frame of the building is still very viable to current code. Many times we have to spend $5 to $10 million just with seismic upgrades. And I believe this building were less than $500,000. So the age of the building does matter. Of course, how the building is built structurally, is it a concrete building? Is it a steel building? Is it a wood building? Matters as well. But I think those three parameters, before we even start to do a capacity study, is something that we ask before putting pencil to paper. And if all those are positive, then we'll do a capacity study. We'll bring a structural engineer on board, and we'll take that next step to dig a little deeper. And if that process is positive and yields the right results for the developer, then we'll just continue to dig deeper and deeper and bring on more consultants. And obviously, the owner has to spend more and more money to work through these issues.
Is there much work done on the facade when you approach these projects?
It depends on the type of project. We have an office building. It was a mid-century building completed in, I believe it was 1967 in Santa Ana. And it's an affordable housing deal. So it's along Main Street, north of downtown, which is actually turning into an emerging arts corridor. It has the Bowers Museum. It has the Orange County School of the Arts. It has a ballet studio. And when our client, an affordable housing developer, got control of it, we thought that this would be a great place to have an artist collective, where it would be affordable housing for families with an artist preference. And it's very interesting, in the affordable housing world, you cannot dictate who can occupy an affordable space except by age, meaning senior housing is allowed, or if you're an artist. And I don't know who snuck that in, but it's actually quite brilliant, because we were able to convert this building from an office building to 48 affordable housing units with an artist preference. And so the ground floor is activated with a gallery. There are some artists are operating on the ground floor and have access to the public directly. There is a messy room or an artist space where artists can work. There are rooms for performing, practicing if you're working with a particular instrument. There are video rooms. And it's just helped bring another artist-related amenity to the Main Street corridor. And as Santa Ana, as many cities in Southern California, continue to have higher costs and some areas are gentrifying, this will instill that, at least for the next 55 years, that artists will have an affordable, safe place to continue to practice their artwork. Hmm.
Are these units, one, are they more rental focused? And two, do you see one housing type being the most useful for this effort?
It's really a mixed bag. With our affordable folks, the units on the ground floor were more traditional artist spaces. Like you would think there might be a loft in there with concrete floors. We exposed the concrete ceilings, very open, very flexible. But then on the upper floors in that particular building, we had many 2 and 3 bedroom units for folks that had families and needed more privacy. Though the living rooms are still very flexible to either occupy as a resident or to create art in. Our market rate projects tend to be a mixture of that as well. The ground floor of most of these buildings are pretty tall, so we can sometimes put townhomes in or lofts. And our 200 Ocean project in Long Beach, which is an 11-story building, it has a tall ground floor, so we have loft units there. The middle of the building actually has what we call flats that are 1, 2, and 3 bedroom units. And then on the roof, we learned through the process that there was a lot of original equipment on that roof that weighed a lot. And we were able to put newer equipment that is lighter in character on the roof. And we were able to put townhomes on top as well. So we created 8 townhomes units on the top floor. And I think this idea of creating a variety of housing units is really good. It helps to fill up buildings quicker in terms of an absorption rate. When you have 106 units coming on the market all at once, and you only have 1 or 2 or 3 standard types of units, it takes time to fill those up. But if you have a variety of different units, you attract a broader audience, and the lease-up rates tend to be much better.
Yeah. And there's studies that have shown that when you have that mixed income level, rather than all one way or another, typically performs much better across the board.
And I think you have a richer community for it. You know, when you have folks at different economic levels and that mixing that just naturally occurs in the public areas or at the amenities, I think it's just makes, I think it makes for better cities and better communities within each of our buildings.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but for those that are in the multifamily sector, I imagine that there's quite a bit of cost savings compared to building a new structure, because these, the technical side of the separation required between units and all of that stuff, a lot of it is kind of baked into it to an extent in a commercial building. Am I reading that right?
Well, I think, I think to some degree, I think the stairwells, the elevator cores, you know, any shafts that you have, they're pretty much in general up to code or can be easily brought up to code. We do, you know, an office floor plan is generally pretty open. The walls that divide individual tenants usually, well, we always take them down and kind of start with a clear slate. I think the bigger bit benefit is that we're keeping the shell of the building, the structure of the building, the flooring, sometimes the windows. You know, with the Santa Ana project that was affordable, we had a very tight budget and those windows were actually vulcanized in. And our glazing consultant said, you know, these are going to be really hard to take out and to put in. And they said, they all work. I would just leave it the way it is. And so those windows are still original from when the building was completed and it's performing quite fine. Every building has its own set of challenges and issues. And so it really is a case by case issue. You know, sometimes we do keep parts of the exterior facade in terms of the glazing and storefront. And other times it just, it doesn't make sense, mostly from a heat gain or heat loss perspective.
That's interesting. Regarding the windows. Now, if you're changing up the layout and dicing it up into these smaller pieces and you still have that glazing, you're changing the proportions of the heat gain to the space ratio, sort of. How have you guys navigated? It's probably getting more into the mechanical side, but is there a complexity uncovered from that perspective that you have to kind of balance?
Yeah. You know, I think the 200 Ocean example of where we set the building in 8 feet, because first of all, the floor plate was just so deep. But using that to create balconies, which in a market rate project is valuable, but at the same time, by setting these tall storefronts in that 8 feet, those balconies provide shade since it is south facing really all day. And that does really help take the pressure off the mechanical loads for those units. Now on the north side, you don't have those type of issues. So we kept the units right on the facade of the building. And in that building in particular, it was really interesting because the east and west facades didn't have any windows on them. They were just solid walls. And strictly from a heat gain or heat loss perspective, that was good. Now, what we did is we did add a sliver of windows to both of those facades because we needed to add a bedroom in from an economic perspective, and we needed to get a window in there. But there are other ways of mitigating that through canopies or vertical shades, depending on if it's south or east or west facing.
Now, shifting into construction, are any of the projects that you have, are any of those or all of those built out already?
The ones that I've referred to have been occupied for many years. We have six of them completed and we have right now three on the boards. And I think one thing that we've learned, particularly in Long Beach, since our office is located in downtown Long Beach, we were able to kind of track our work very easily. And we have talked to Gray Starr, who is the operating manager for the 200 Ocean development. And we found that as new housing comes on board, that many folks that live in the newer developments will move to the newest development because they'll get a deal cut or they just want to be, you know, the first in a brand new home. And so there is a certain percentage of developments within the downtown that have a shift of population that occurs. But we have found with the 200 Ocean Project, because it is so unique, it has 12-foot high ceilings, it has almost floor-to-ceiling glazing, it has concrete walls and unique features that new construction cannot compete with. Not only are the rents higher than most of the newer developments that are coming in, but the tenants are staying longer because they understand that they're in a unique place and they want to be part of that unique place versus some of the newer, more cookie cutter, you know, standard new construction that you see being, you know, 8 stories with 5 levels of wood frame construction over 3 stories of concrete. So it does give a competitive advantage, which is something we've kind of inherently assumed would be the case, but we're finding now, at least for 200 Ocean, is actually true.
Now, on the construction side, what complexities did you kind of encounter in actually making this work?
Well, a developer wants to try to spend as little money as possible until the end and then just go full force at the end and get these things built. And what we try to push is, at the very least, selective demolition, where you demolish areas on the ground floor, maybe on the somewhere in the middle of the building, and then at the top of the building, to understand what those conditions are, because they're there, they're in place. We're not building something from scratch. And what we've found and what we really like to encourage is just doing the demolition all at once as soon as possible to just get the unknowns and the surprises out of the way. And that is a battle, because that is a cost that can be delayed, but it does then guarantee a risk that also is delayed. And we had found, again, on the Santa Ana project, we did selective demolition and noticed on every floor we had, you know, we had the original drawings. We noticed the floor roof framing was consistent on every floor. Well, once we got to the top floor, the drawings showed it being consistent, but in reality, they built the framing the opposite direction, which had some issues that we had to rework with mechanical and plumbing and all of those things. And delaying construction in the field, where there are guys out there with hammers ready to go, is much more expensive than doing it months in advance when we're just creating the drawings and having to change the drawings, or even doing it before we start the drawings is more efficient. So there will be surprises, and we just can't guess what those are until these buildings are opened up.
Yeah. If I asked you what is the most unique detail that comes to mind that you guys had to work out on any of these projects, is there one particular one that comes to mind where you're just like reworking how these materials or this condition's going to actually work?
Well, many times it's the structural system. Like I mentioned earlier, this structurally bringing these things up to code or up to a level of safety is the most expensive part of this project or these developments. And, you know, can we internalize the structure? Can it be in the corridors and away from the storefront? Because we want those large expanses of glass to be enjoyed by the residents. But sometimes there's a cost to that. And so then we have to look at, can we do a brace frame on the facade? And many times that's also too expensive. So then we have to do diagonal framing, which then starts to interfere with view lines or creating glazing conditions that become more complex. We are looking at a system right now for 400 Ocean Gate, another development in Long Beach. It's an 11-story building or 14-story building. And we're looking at diagonal bracing that is inbound, and it is a system that can be purchased off the shelf so that those braces are very small. They may be as small as 4 inches in diameter. And we think that that will be delicate enough to at least be as least intrusive as possible for the residents that really want to enjoy these views, particularly on the upper floors of the water or of the port or of views of Southern Orange County.
Before we wrap up, I want to zoom back out a little bit. You had mentioned these particular buildings kind of getting higher rents for building owners. Are you seeing, sounds like you did a few of them within Long Beach area, Are you seeing existing buildings rental rates go down or stay the same or move up a little bit? How have you seen this added housing trickle out to the overall housing market?
You know, places like New York, Washington, D.C., Chicago, and Los Angeles or Southern California in general, we still need a lot of housing. And so even now with the economy where it is, there is still a demand for housing. Even though our population isn't growing as fast as it was in the past, there are just so many folks that are bunking up together or living with their parents or living in tight conditions with others that there's still a demand for housing. And we have not yet, at least the Long Beach area, seen a decline in rents. I think the pace of housing rent increases has stopped dramatically. It's stabilized. It's still increasing slightly, but it's probably healthy. You know, we can't just have rents going up every year at the pace that they have been going up since 2008. And having reprieve so that incomes can catch up and people can spend money on other things is really important. And I do think adding more housing to Southern California is still important. As long as housing rents don't collapse or fall dramatically, I think it's a healthy period, just like when rents do go escalate higher. And I think we need these periods of just taking a breath and catching up. And I do think market rate housing has slowed, and it may have something to do with rents, but you know, interest rates are higher, construction costs continue to go up. The labor force is challenged. We have workers that are boomers that are retiring. We have immigrants that are having a hard time working in the construction industry right now. So there's just a lot of factors that are impacting both adaptive reuse and new construction for housing. But if we can tame some of these issues, I think housing will bounce back very strong. And like I said, there still is a demand here in Southern California and in other cities for more housing.
Well, this has been great, Michael. I really appreciate your time. Is there anything that you wished I would have asked you, or one thing that you think that people should know?
Well, I would say for cities, anyone that works for a city or that wants to entice office-to-housing conversions, you do need an adaptive reuse ordinance. We're working right now with the city of Riverside to create that. If you don't have an ordinance in place, there are just too many unknowns for a developer to come in and take a risk on doing a conversion, even with the city having the best intent. So I think the first step for cities is to create an adaptive reuse ordinance. It's really helped, like I mentioned earlier, for downtown Los Angeles over time, 12,000 units were built. I could see it in Long Beach and Santa Ana, where just hundreds of units have been created for those cities. And they've taken buildings that were actually being threatened in terms of property taxes and brought new energy and life and have stabilized property tax revenues, not only for the state, but for local jurisdictions. So if there is one thing I would say from a citywide perspective is develop an adaptive reuse ordinance. And that's from a planning perspective, as well as thinking from a building perspective. I've seen so many deals that have not happened because a building official will say, or a fire department official will say, well, the elevators are not the right size for a gurney. And I think cities like Long Beach, who have been really flexible and said, okay, this elevator almost fits, but it doesn't quite fit. You know, if a gurney has to tilt 10, 12, 20 degrees to work, will allow that to happen. And I think that creative flexibility and partnership is really important, because these buildings are in place. They weren't designed to be this way for current code. And we have to try to find modifications and other ways of allowing the buildings to perform safely and to protect the welfare and health of occupants. But we have to do it in a more flexible way and look at modifications and variances that still protect residents and occupants, but are maybe not the normative way of solving these problems.
That's a great way to wrap up, Michael. For those that want to follow along with Studio 111, or cities that want to kind of follow along and reach out to you to help them, what's the best way that they can reach out to you or the studio?
Calling us or just reaching out on our website is, we're always responsive, and we love this type of work, and we just have a lot of fun with it, and it's very fulfilling, and we always look forward to working on these types of projects. We've, like I mentioned to you earlier, we've done about 36 adaptive reuse projects of almost every type and vein, and they just bring a lot of fulfillment and enjoyment for all of us.
And what's the website? Studio?
Studio-111.com.
Okay. And we'll link to that in the show notes. Michael, thanks again. Thank you to the listeners for listening. And we will talk again on the next one. Thanks. Thanks for listening. Spaces is brought to you by Lines, my Southern California-based architecture and creative studio that provides services focused on custom homes, home renovations, creative office, and specialty retail spaces. Find out more at lines.studio. That's lines.studio. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question about the built environment or just want to share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. Looking for similar content? Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com, and that's gablemedia.com. And lastly, before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content from this episode, visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.